And you're listening to IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And so this week, well, this past week, whichever week it was, we won't even say the date.
This is the week that was.
This is. That we were in.
But that was the week that was.
That was, certainly. We were in Jerusalem. I was in Jerusalem with my brother, and we met up with Yoram at the Western Wall, the Kotel, where all the big commotion has been going on, which I was kind of shocked at all of the commotion, since considering there was not much happening, and it was far enough away from the Temple Mount for any kind of discussion about us wrecking the joint.
This is a replay of a continual soap opera. One of the important moments in the soap opera was in 1929, when a couple of what were called in those days biryonim, tough guys from the group that later became the Likud, declared their intention of taking over the Temple Mount. 1929, we're talking now.
Wow.
And
there were Jews here, excuse me, before World War II, huh?
Before World War II.
Wow.
Right, just close after World War I. Anyway.
Is that revisionist history, or is that just the truth?
It could be the truth. It could be the truth. But let's assume that this story that I'm about to tell is, in fact, true, as far as I know it is. This occasioned various outcries among the Muslim community and the mosques by the religious leaders that the mosque was in danger. And there followed a cycle of riots against Jews, which finished the Jewish communities in a number of cities, the most important of which was Hebron, which had had a continuous Jewish community for close to 3,000 years. Jews were also murdered and expelled from Gaza, where they had lived for a long time, from Nablus, Shechem, and so on. And this is a constant phrase, a constant, a reoccurring focus for the Muslims in this part of the world, that the Temple Mount Al-Aqsa is in danger. And by and large, they don't like to even call it the Temple Mount, because they claim that there was no temple there. You know, one of the high points or low points, depending on how you look at it, of the Camp David encounter in 2000 was when Yasser Arafat told President Clinton that the Jews never had a temple in Jerusalem. And according to the reports, Clinton just about could not even react to it. He was so shocked to hear this new fact that which not only, you know, destroys wipes out a Jewish relationship, but doesn't do the Christian relationship to Jerusalem any good, and makes one wonder what all the churches and monasteries and the significance of Jerusalem to the Christian world, if it wasn't that the Jew Jesus came to the Jewish temple at Pesach, as people were supposed to do those many years ago.
That comment reminded me of some of the sci-fi movies where, you know, you go back in time and you erase, undo certain things so that the future no longer exists in the same form. So Arafat went back, made the Jews non-existent, and therefore the Christians no longer exist as a result, and the world is, according to Arafat, is all Islam, all Muslim. So this
not,
is definitely...
Not a bad shot, but they went even better. They went almost one further, I would say. They also claim that it was built in the time of Abraham and or in the time of Adam. And more Muslim academics are claiming that it existed before Jesus and Moses, and that Islam, in fact, preceded Judaism in Jerusalem. And today, thousands of Islamic rulings, publications, and sources deny the Jewish roots in Jerusalem and its holy places, and they claim that the temple didn't even exist in Jerusalem, but was located in Nablus, or Yemen. And there's even an Islamic legal pronouncement, a fatwa, of the Jerusalem Muslim Religious Trust, the Waqf, that says that King Solomon and King Herod did not build the temple at all, but merely refurbished an existing structure that had been there since the days of Abraham. And today, many Muslims call the temple the greatest fraud, crime in history, and the style is also to add the term so-called in front of the word temple. So it really comes as no surprise. The terror, of course, is that the rescue archaeology digs will in fact bring to light archaeological evidence. And this is what this is one half of what this conflict is about. The other half, of course, is a power struggle over who is the boss in Jerusalem. And the Muslims insist that the Jews have no claim, no rights, no anything to Jerusalem, and that they, in fact, are sovereign not only on the Temple Mount, that, I think, 25 or 30 acres, but around it. And, of course, now they're talking about, what was that, 20, 30 feet outside of the wall, and then if
at least.
Then they can go for 50 or 60 feet, and it's like that rock that you throw in the pond, right? The circle just keeps expanding and expanding, with the intention, obviously, as we know, of it eventually encompassing the world.
I think any time we do any kind of excavation, and the greatest fear is on us uncovering more proof of our existence there, and that the temple artifacts that only support what everybody already knows, including the Muslims, that we've been here and we've had a couple of temples on top of that mount. And we were very fortunate, and we actually went through a tunnel, the tunnel tour, which was unbelievably revealing. And the realization for me is that the Western Wall, the part of the wall which is a very small part of the Western Wall, the Kotel, of where we actually pray, that it goes all the way tens of meters
north
through the tunnel. You can actually see the original wall because it was cut off by the Arabs building their houses level with the Temple Mount, where previously, before the Arabs built their houses, the walkways were well below the Temple Mount. You had to walk up these stairs, obviously, to get to this place of prayer and ritual slaughter and so forth. And they built it, but they built it right next to the wall. I wonder if it was on purpose or not, in order to almost eliminate any view of that part of the wall that the Jews have, since the destruction, have held as holy, or as a place, a space in which to put energy in prayer, you know, and get inspiration from. And it was just a fantastic experience to see how amazingly structured that wall is. You know, I felt really inspired by that whole tour. I'm part of this continuity, this continuation, not in a sense that separates me from, but actually unites me with even everybody around, including Muslims. That's why I felt when I came out, I said, I used the word pissy, how pissy this whole thing is, that they're making such an issue out of something, when if they would just open up and realize that we're not out to do them in, but we're out to live side by side with them, that this could be an incredibly dramatic and inspiring place for both parties, and as a result, the rest of the world. It's just so small-minded. Call it whatever you want, fear, anger. It's sometimes mind-boggling that something so simple has been made so complicated, when in essence everybody could benefit.
I'd like to make two short comments on that, Steve. One is for listeners who at some point in the future will come to visit in Israel and Jerusalem. You need to make a reservation to go on the temple tour.
Yes.
There are only so many people can fit in that the tunnel tour. And you should do that. And it's a minimal cost, and there's a tour guide, and there's some models which help explain where you are and what was there in the past and what in relation to what you're seeing today. The last time we had one of these big events over Israeli activities around the Temple Mount, something like 60 people died as a result of the outrage that the Muslims created, that we were attacking the temple, that the temple was in danger. Now, here, a number of years have passed since then. That was during the prime ministership of Benjamin Netanyahu, so it's been a few years. At that point, the Israeli government and the people involved in the work claimed that there was no attempt here to undermine the temple or to attack the temple or to do anything with the temple. This tunnel has existed now for a number of years, and in point of fact, it has not endangered the Temple Mount. The only thing that's happened is that in the middle of the tunnel, at the point that is determined to have been closest to the Holy of Holies, 24 hours a day people sit, and remember we came to that little cropping mm-hmm. in the tunnel, and say psalms in order to try and heal and all the religious purposes there are behind that kind of an act. But the temple, the mount itself, has not been touched, has not been hurt, has not been affected. And in X number of years, 10, 12, 20 years from now, looking back at what they've done, what they're doing at the Mugrabi Gate, and the noise and the riots that there's an attempt to create around this event, again, we'll see that it was a phony baloney,
issue,
and that in fact what Israel claimed it was doing is what it is going is the limit of what it's doing, which is rebuilding a entryway to one of the doors in the wall around the mount. And according to Israeli law, before that's done, there has to be, especially in a place like Jerusalem, and even more especially so close to the Temple Mount, an archaeological dig to determine and to rescue any archaeological items that they may find, which helps shed light on the past.
I.e., the reason that they're excavating is that they're careful, that they just don't throw the dirt out without looking and screening to see if there are any artifacts, which is exactly what the WAF did when they supposedly were reconstructing or parts of the Temple Mount and took tons of dirt, unauthorized, without permission, and dumped it in a dump somewhere without looking to see what was in it, because they were afraid and knew that in where they were digging, there would be artifacts showing Jewish presence. And in fact, when the archaeologists went in there to find and realize that what they had done and went digging, what did they find? They found Jewish artifacts. The problem was, like you had previously stated, that the layer in which it was found is no longer available because they dug it all up and no one knows at what depth this was found. But it just shows you that it's such a double standard and it's such hypocrisy that they've conspiring in every way possible to, one, prove that we don't exist there, have never existed there, that there was never a temple, and two, they were so afraid of Israeli sovereignty on even the Jewish parts of the old city, which in fact is where we're digging, in the Jewish quarters.
To place this a little bit in context, some people may remember in 1998, the Taliban in Afghanistan destroyed this enormous Buddha.
Tragedy. Buddhas.
Many Buddhas, but there was one in particular that was particularly huge, and you know they showed it on television and so on. And part of what that expressed and what we're experiencing again today is a disregard by Islam of the heritage of anyone other than themselves, of everyone else. And that's really...
extreme.
It's extreme, but it's real. That's really how they feel. That's really what they teach. This is what they teach their the next generation. And this is what's heard in all the media that's available. And it's a developing. It's not particularly according to the tradition. According to the tradition, the holy sites are Mecca and Medina. And Jerusalem was a tertiary site. Now, one of the things that cracks me up, there was a TV show with a number of experts, and people were so awed by the fact that this is the third holiest site in Islam, and therefore we need to, you know, stand on our heads rather than even come close to disturbing it. Yet nobody seems to be impressed by the fact that this is the first holiest site in Judaism.
It doesn't count for much, apparently, in the world.
I mean, if there are holy sites that people think are important, and I personally don't. I mean, I'm not a holy site person. I don't go to the Kotel very much, it's just not something that I feel is important to me, or that's particularly real. But there are people who feel this way, and I think it's their right, at least if, according to my belief in the right of unrestricted religious expression, that these people have to have the right to express their religious sensitivities. And not only Jews, but also the Muslims, and also the Buddhists, and also the Hindus, and I mean everybody. Not that I share that experience or that belief, but their belief is their belief, and they're entitled to it, and I believe it should be respected by everyone. We will see what happens over there.
Yes, I heard, you know, there's going to be I'm sure there's going to be changing events and decisions by this government possibly suspend temporarily the excavation, according to what I've been listening to just recently. Either way, this whole thing is a bogus issue. There's a lot more Arabs in the world and a lot more sympathy for Arabs in the world for a variety of different reasons than there are for the State of Israel, including, apparently, from what I'm gathering lately in the newspaper with an article by Sharansky. In certain social parlors, it's quite legitimate to even discuss whether Israel has a right to exist. You really wonder, or not so surprised at the boldness that the powers that be here in the Muslim world have, and towards, and the audacity towards trying to snuff out this incredible and amazing miracle, as far as I'm concerned, in the State of Israel. So what do you think about the anti-Semitism? I mean, is it a serious issue? Is it something that you think that we need to deal with in a more aggressive and proactive way? According to Sharansky, he thinks that it should be dealt with just like the events of Soviet Jewry, with demonstrations in the streets, proactive stand in terms of every time there's an Iranian official in the West, confront them in a nonviolent way, but constantly stalk them, confront them, and confront the new anti-Semitism, as he says, in a global manner in which the Jews should be in the forefront, just like they were in the saving of Russian Jewry, of which, of course, he, Sharansky, was in the gulag for God knows how many years until there was a swap, prisoner swap with him. Well, I mean, what's your take on this?
I'm glad you brought that up, Steve. I'd like to remind our listeners that they can read this article on the Jerusalem Post website. The title of the article is Mobilize Now, Nothing Less Than Save the World, by Natan Sharansky. I haven't read the article yet. From what you say, he writes, there's no surprises there. On the other hand, can't quite imagine that the energy and the investment in time and in resources that the Free Soldier Jury movement generated will come alive now. On partly because the conspiracy to demonize Israel has been incredibly successful, and also to a degree of mistakes that Israel has made has contributed to it. But it's a never ending. You see, this is part of it. It's the Nazi big lie again. If you say the same lie often enough and with enough conviction, and as if this is really the truth, and you say it enough, people believe it. And that's really what we're experiencing now as far as the demonization of the State of Israel is concerned. And I am always in favor of a proactive approach, particularly in Israeli propaganda and Israeli attempts to express its point of view on the issues that are very proactively taken up by the Arab world. It's not only the Arab world, mind you. There's also, outside of the 200 or 300 million Arabs, there's also something like 700 million Muslims out there who were basically subject to the same sermons and to the same propaganda and to the same incitement, and fundamentally vote along the lines of all the anti-Israel propositions that come before institutions like the United Nations.
Sharansky is actually making, at the very end, is making an appeal saying that if we're not proactive, if we don't go out there and show our united support as Jews, and of course others will join us, there will be others that will supports Israel and supports Jews' right to live here, we can prevent what he called the second Holocaust, because he feels the trend, the way things are going, that it's not an impossibility for another Holocaust, which we all know is possible. The threat of which Israel is under is from Iran and others around us, I mean, in real time, under the right circumstances. You know, certainly Hezbollah and certainly Egypt, even though we technically have a peace policy with them, at the same time, at best it's been cold, but there hasn't been war. But at any time, we also know how volatile it is in Egypt, and the possibility of the regime, you know, disappearing is not an impossibility.
And Jordan as well.
And Jordan too. So everything is quite volatile in the region, and it's real
as
easy.
Usual.
I don't have the energy for it, but I can really see the importance of getting, you know, and mobilizing Jews globally. And I think that's not going to happen until Jews themselves really feel threatened, not only here, but in other parts of the world, are threatened to the point where they realize that they have to be proactive and really stop, that this is it. We're making a stand at this moment in time, and we're saying no more. We're not allowing the free flow of anti-Semitism to just express itself and be accepted in the mainstream of new anti-Semitism. And he does distinguish between the legitimate criticism of Israeli policy, which we're all open to, we do our share, and using Israel or delegitimizing Israel or criticizing Israel for the purpose of trying to delegitimize its right to have a place and a space here.
Well, you know, what happens often is that people are critical without the intention of delegitimizing or of causing harm to the state or to the Jewish people. And I think that there's a necessity to aware oneself of the difference between the intention, which is to criticize policies which we believe are not helpful and don't contribute, in fact, to the security of the state and the people, and the effect that some of these things have, that some of these statements have on a wider scale, not just within the Jewish community, and the degree to which they give comfort and aid to the enemy and ammunition. I mean, this is a form of ammunition at this point in time and space, statements made by certain Jews, by certain Israelis. And one of the things that strikes me very strongly is that I don't think there's anything any American Jew has said about Israel negative that has not been said by an Israeli Jew negative about Israel. So it's not just how can you criticize from out there, because there's plenty of that criticism from in here, a lot of it justified criticism. This is a far from a perfect country. But some of it is really has a nasty flavor to it, and even more than the nasty flavor that's intended is the nastiness to which it's then used, dafka, at this time in our history and the history of the planet. Which, I mean, the issue in Iran is not only with the Jews, it's the Shiites and the Sunnis, and it's the Arabs and the non-Arab Muslims, because the Iranians are not Arabs, although they're Muslims, and so on and so forth. So it becomes a far more complex issue than just the Jews and the Arabs or Israel and the Arabs, and it requires a lot more thought before speaking, before, how did that one go, engage brain before operating mouth. There was used to be a little cutie like that, like a bumper sticker. And I think that's really necessary, that for people to take responsibility and to understand that their words, first of all, they really would like their words to have results. They would like something to happen when they speak. But then they need to understand that what happens from some of their words is not necessarily what they intend.
Unintended consequences.
For instance, I told you before that somebody wrote that they should name the main boulevard of Tehran after George W. Bush because he has unintentionally provided them with access to Iraq. The last time they tried to gain access to Iraq, there were tens and hundreds of thousands of people killed. Billions of dollars were wasted in a war that now they don't have to wage the war. They're just going to walk in and pick up the pieces, which makes George W. Bush a real hero of the Iranian
people,
right, of the mullahs. And that's certainly not his intention. I mean, however you disagree or agree with him, that obviously was not what he intended. But that's, in fact, what seems to be happening. And the same unintended consequences happen within our community. Things that people say, criticisms that people make, in a way using language and using in inferences that come to be very destructive.
Unless there is a segment which we have shared off mic within the community, not in the Israeli community particularly, although there are some here, there isn't a real feeling of Jewishness, whatever that means, or an embarrassment of that feeling, where there's a desire, and consciously or not, of really wanting to eliminate what they consider to be a elitist
embarrassment.
Yeah, that we have a uniquely Jewish state. I mean, why should Jews have their own place, particularly
for the same reason that French do?
Yes, but they don't quite see it that way, apparently. I think it makes them very uncomfortable, especially if you were Jew by birth, and that growing up in a secular, just let's use the States, for example, I mean, really feeling, for the most part, most Jews never really experienced direct anti-Semitism. You know, feeling free and feeling liberated, feeling no particular attachment to being Jewish.
Or American in some cases.
Or American in some cases. Very good point. And that all of a sudden there's this Jewish country staring you in the face with all the propaganda about how terrible it is, and all of a sudden you feel personally responsible or don't want to feel personally responsible, and all you want to do is see it disappear so you can live in your harmony with that, like with everybody else, and recede into the woodwork. But it just doesn't seem to work that way, does it?
It might for some people. We don't know that because we are obviously, in our lives, fairly far away from just receding.
That is true. Well, an interesting program.
We haven't done a Stephen Yoram program for a while on IsraelScene.com.
So anyway, this is IsraelScene.com. I'm Steve.
He's Steve, and I'm Yoram.
I'm Steve.
You're Steve.
You're Yoram.
I'm Yoram.
Now,
right. Also.
Also.
Next week, hopefully, we'll have an interview with Bruce Berger, Rebbe Soul, who provides
Fantastic.
Us with the music that we listen, that we play, our closing theme, his version of HaTikvah. He must have been standing next to Jimi Hendrix when Hendrix was playing the Star Spangled Banner, and Bruce must have been blowing HaTikvah.
Well, I happen to be there, but I'll tell you, it's maybe he was playing HaTikvah then too. And it all just kind of come together and meld in together into one God Bless America. Or Star
God Bless everything.
Okay, well, God bless everybody, as they say. So, Israel Scene, and we're on our way out. Have a great week.